The theater, the theater.
Bring out Louis!
Theater, theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater, theater.
Yo.
Hey, what's up?
Hello.
I just wanted to share, Bailey, this is especially for you because it's someone you love. I'm listening to
Stanley
this
Tucci.
No, oh, okay. Better. Go ahead. Better. Go ahead. I'm listening
Random.
To this new podcast right now called Maintenance Phase, and it's really cool because they're debunking diet stuff and healthcare books and all this shit, and I love it. But the episode I'm listening to right now is, did you know that in 1988, Angela Lansbury released a diet book that had accompanying VHS tapes of the workouts?
What? I'd seen her workout stuff before, but
it's
that's
called
pretty...
Positive Moves.
Do I own the VHS tapes?
Do you?
Really?
You?
Oh.
God damn it. I thought I had something.
No, that's incredible. That's incredible. Yes, no, it's true.
It sounds like one of those things that should be like a Mandela effect thing. Like,
sure,
remember when Angela Lansbury did the Jazzercise videos? Well, she never did.
They're playing like a whole, they played a whole clip from this part where she's like, it's her in a bubble bath. And this is her, like, in her early 60s.
All
and
right,
she's
now
talking
I'm really
about the importance of having a healthy sex life.
Yeah.
No matter what you're at. So some of it's pretty cool, but then some of it's kind of problematic. But anyway,
sure.
I just had to share that.
That's
interesting.
So cool.
Yeah, we'll have to watch those sometime as an end stuff. we'll discuss it as a bonus episode. Our guest Kevin and I saw a play together a few nights ago, and I kind of wanted to talk about it because it was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
What a weird experience.
So I'll set it up, and then Kevin, yeah, I want you to tell about the actual audience experience. So I had been wanting to see this play, 222, A Ghost Story, at Center Theater Group, Amundsen. Yeah.
No.
Starring Constance Wu.
Yeah.
And
Anna
Camp. So we were like, I had tickets to it, didn't work out. And then Kevin reached out and said, hey, you want to go see this play? And I said, hell yeah. So we went, and it was like a horror play.
Okay.
And it had some legitimate jump scares.
Oh,
some legitimate jump scares.
Fun.
Like legitimate. Both of
all
us right. like hopping many, many times. and overall an enjoyable experience. However, there's this thing about LA audiences that I don't fully understand. Kevin, talk us through what happened here.
Okay, so it's like it's got some proper scares in it. So yeah. The audience, of course, like anytime you go see like a horror movie in the theaters, there's a lot of tittering, and usually it's because like everybody is really tense,
yeah,
and so somebody will be to try to sort of like distill that energy.
Mm-hmm.
This audience was so bad; they would like, you know, giggle and laugh for a long time after the jump scare.
Yeah.
Minor annoyances. It would have been fine. The guy behind us sounded like he was, I don't know, wrapping Christmas presents in the middle of the day.
Yeah, that was he was unwrapping
what is
food
happening?
Or something. It was a lot.
Minor annoyances. It was all fine. But in the second act, no spoilers in case you're going to go see it. Not at the Amundsen because it's close, but other places.
Yeah.
There's a big character moment, which isn't necessarily a scary bit. And
it's kind of the like thematic crux of the play, though.
Yeah, it's sort of Constance Wu's emotional climax, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's her big moment for that. And she sort of like drops this bomb, and it's a pretty quiet moment on stage, and somebody in the audience goes, oh no.
Oh god.
And that sets the audience off. They start laughing like crazy.
Oh no.
Constance Wu breaks on stage,
breaks.
And then the audience starts
cheering
and clapping like it's fucking SNL.
No, that's when
like
you start Jimmy yelling,
Fallon
don't
broke.
You dare, don't you do it. That's
don't
what I like
it.
Yelling when people are about to break.
She broke and laughed, and then the whole audience cheered it, like he said. And it really was like a fucking Jimmy Fallon moment, and I was like, no, no. And Kevin and I looked at each other dead in the eye like, what is happening? Like, we couldn't believe it. It was so weird. And then it took like 3 minutes to get back into the flow of the play. Like, it just like they were off, they weren't reconnected, like her tears were fake now. Like, all of a sudden it became like a bit that she was crying. Like, we were just like, ah, fell apart. This fell apart. It was bad.
That I have a fun question for y'all concerning theater acting. Do you have any tricks that you use on in moments on stage where you're worried about breaking so that you don't break?
Yeah, it's called commitment, CJ.
Thank you, Bailey.
Fuck the both of you.
No, I don't because... I don't think I have a trick. I just hold it as hard as I can.
Yeah, I can only remember a handful of times where I would get to that point, and it's usually in longer run stuff where you're just sort of, you know, you're in a different level of focus because you've just done it so much. I don't have any tricks for it other than just try and stay focused. Don't do it.
Deep breathe. Deep breathe.
For me, the breaking happens when we would be doing Serial Killers, the old late night show we used to do at Fools, which 90% of the time the scripts were funny, and you've got so many things going in your head because there's been such a lack of rehearsal that things catch you off guard. When I have those moments, I think of something that makes me in real life mad as fuck.
Right on.
And that has saved me sometimes.
I also think there are certain kinds of plays where it is fun for the audience to see the characters break, and it's kind of okay because it's silly, it's campy, it's
sketch
whatever,
is definitely
whatever.
Made
it's real.
Yeah, right?
Sure, like, sure. You know.
So, I don't know. Sometimes it's like, yeah, fine, break, have a good time.
But when you're in like a dramatic catharsis climax of a thriller play, which did walk the line of comedy in moments, but this moment was not that.
It sounds like it derailed everything.
Yeah, and you know, I've been in audiences everywhere on the planet where things happen like that, where an audience member probably just they just felt something and they let it out and they didn't mean to. This felt performative. This felt on purpose. Yeah, sure. It felt like somebody being like, oh no, for everybody else, right? It felt like they were about to stand up and give a bow afterwards, right?
It sounds like y'all were almost like in the Globe with an Elizabethan or Jacobian audience.
Segue of all segues. No, that's real. And we appreciate that. We appreciate that.
On that note, have you heard of Murphy's Law? The intentional misspelling. I know, it's a great name. It's an intentional misspelling of Murphy's Law, which says that when you correct something, inevitably you will say something wrong, which happened to me last week when I was like,
yes,
Scott.
Yes.
I think I know what you're talking about.
It's like, Queen Elizabeth died in 1903, which, which is not
close.
Right.
She
That's
died in
right
2022.
1603 is when she died. 16, so, There, I
it's
interrupted
okay.
our segue to...
No, it's perfect. We got to fix things from
Kevin,
last time.
Kevin's editor's note.
We got so much hate mail for that, Kevin.
We
Thanks.
Did.
No,
some
I
of.
Like,
that
awesome,
dumb
Kevin.
Son of a bitch you had as a guest. Dear asshole, who do you think you are? Yeah.
Austin Almond was pissed.
My rating.
Yeah. Right, right. Okay, y'all. Okay. Shout out to Austin Almond.
Hi, Austin.
He engages with us a lot, and we appreciate it.
Yes.
I'll tell a story about Austin at the end of the episode, actually, because he sent us a really interesting story about his first directing opportunity recently, and it was
Oh, cool.
Good. So I'll tell about it later. Anyway, shout out to Austin. Welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds made by three theater makers from the L.A. theater scene. I'm Jay Bailey Burcham.
I'm C.J. Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
Correct. And each week, we get together to discuss, debate, and disseminate the evolutions of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at three of their plays.
your face as you busted yourself is like
I don't like it. I don't like it. And this is part three of three. That's right. It's the finale of our miniseries covering the works, the histories of William Shakespeare, the bard himself. That's right. It's the life of Hencast the Podth.
Yes.
Nope.
There will be dysentery.
Kevin's
in the
arms
end of this
are
episode,
crossed.
Y'all.
Yeah. It's okay, Kevin. It's okay. But during this series, we will be joined, of course, by the man himself, if you've already heard discuss and correct himself in a little correction corner and everything. Dear friend and actor and producer, Kevin Shuey. Hey.
Yay.
Hello. Thanks for having me back. Thank you. It's fun. Yeah. It's fun to be here.
Yeah. Well, we almost fired you after all that hate mail.
I know.
Thanks for giving me another shot.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah.
Cool. Well, so there's nothing we got to do at the top of this episode except just jump into it. There's a bunch of stuff we're going to do at the back end.
At the back end of it, yeah.
But
in the back,
which butt also end. Could
back
be the
nine.
Mouth.
Henry five.
But it yeah. could be the mouth. Good one, Siege. Good pull.
Okay. let's start. Let's get into it. Let's talk about this. This is a big play. If it is very possible that people are joining us on this episode and not having listened to the first two parts of the miniseries, because this is one of those plays that, you know, you might just be looking up Henry V. So welcome if you're new.
Yeah.
But we're talking today about Henry V. The end of the tetralogy, the Henriad tetralogy, probably written around 1599. I don't. Something.
It's one of the last ones, right? Y'all mentioned that.
It's the last of the histories, right?
No, Henry VIII.
Oh, Henry VIII is
right. The last, which is one of the last ones he writes. This is a little earlier. This is maybe, I don't know. He's got some time. He writes some more after this. But there's some interesting things to talk about up top, but we like to do something first, and that's learn what this motherfucker's about. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that was vulgar, but you get it. CJ.
Fucking vulgar.
Break it down.
Okay.
CJ's breakdown.
To the Shakespearean Times Eye, a telling of the beloved hero king, Henry V, and his bravery and leadership when he led England to conquer France and, in the end, win the love of the French princess. To the modern eye, some pro-English nationalist propaganda about an heir to the throne that failed his way upwards until he became king, decided to start a crooked, church-sanctioned war because he wanted France's land and stuff, and also the French princess, who he force kisses in the last scene, even though she insists it's not proper. Take your pick.
Wow.
Sure.
Wow,
yeah.
That's provocative. That's provocative.
That's the people going.
I say this loving Henry V, too. Like, I mean, we were gabbing about it yesterday. The speeches and, like, but...
I feel like you could say the same exact breakdown for the movie, the Kushner-Spielberg duo movie, Lincoln. Oh. And the reason I say that is just because it's nationalist. It's not, right? So, like, and I think in a lot of ways what's interesting about this person, Henry V, is that he is kind of that in this culture. He's kind of an Abraham Lincoln hero. Yeah.
He's huge.
There's like a thousand Henry V plays. This was just the one that beat them all. You know?
Henry V and the Battle of Agincourt is like so baked into English history at the point.
And I did have right wing written down, but I switched it to national.
Well, and
I mean,
it's interesting to start talking about that because one of the things that I read about was because he was so big, you could do so much with it. So, for example, Olivier in his Henry V, which he made in 1944, is very patriotic. It's very, we will save the day. We will have the day. And then you cut to Branagh's in 89, and it's very anti-war. It's very much like focused on kind of the horrors of battle and all that, both still elevating him. But you're right, because I also think that so much of this play is after Henry IV parts 1 and 2, here's this young man who's taking the thing, and he's forced to do some fucked up things. And he asks himself, is this fucked up because I'm doing it, or is it fucked up because I'm doing it for me?
Contextually, I think something interesting that we sort of talked about in our Richard II episode is the time around this when he's writing this whole tetralogy, a few decades before he writes this, the English Navy beats the Spanish Armada, right? And the English coast or whatever, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And they're writing on this high of nationalism, and they have been for like 30 years, right? And he's definitely playing to Elizabeth a little bit here, and we'll talk about how and why later. But something I wanted to state real quick before we get too deep into it about CJ's breakdown is that France, this is just an interesting tidbit that I found out. France hates this play.
Of course.
My question was, is there a French Henry V? Because I would love to read that.
Oh, maybe, like from the other perspective? French version, maybe.
Kind of like the way Henry VI tears down Joan of Arc?
It's very possible. But
I'm just curious.
An interesting piece of history is that this play was like so hated by the French, for obvious reasons, that it was not performed in France until 1999. Wow. And was edited heavily. And I don't know what that means. Like, I don't know how they edited it, but it was just sort of that they were just like, yeah, and it was pretty different. They did some stuff. And I was like, oh.
Shakespeare isn't particularly good to anyone in this play that isn't English.
It's very
George Bernard Shaw. There is a lot of writing and dialect in this play.
Besides giving, same with Henry VI, I would argue, because besides giving Jones some like solid monologues, you know, there's really, it's a lot of English.
Kevin, you
love
were about
up
to say
here.
Something.
No. I just think it's like an interesting. To me, this is like one of Shakespeare's like purest Shakespeare plays. Like the structure is really clean. The speeches are incredible.
Yes.
I think this is like him perfecting his format before in his later canon when he starts like fucking with things and like not writing in iambic pentameter as much and really doing some weird shit with the problem plays. So to me, it's just like so interesting to look at this play. And particularly as like a nationalist piece, because of course he was playing at the home crowd here. He knew what they wanted.
Yeah.
Well, and he's putting it.
And we talked about this about Richard II too. He's also just sort of in his sweet spot in that sort of mid-career thing. Because isn't Hamlet like right before or right after this? Like,
I have to pull up my notes.
Pull it up. But I seem to recall that it's close in there. I could be wrong, but. Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's so big. And we should also talk about, like, in terms of history.
Yeah, Hamlet is, like, 2 years later in the chronology.
Yeah, so he's, like, he's just, like...
Wow.
Like
he's just teeing up and tapping his cleats and knocking
him
out of the park.
And that's another fascinating thing. We talked last week about Richard II and how it's just physically tight on the page. Just the way that the lines are done. And this is similar.
Within this year?
Yeah,
this is a big year.
Within this year, he writes Much Ado, Henry V, Julius, and As You Like It, and potentially Twelfth Night.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah. Like he's in it, man. Like he's in it. And and the clarity of his themes, I think, are also huge.
And then Hamlet's the next year. Yeah. Hamlet's the next year. Yeah.
And
NBD.
Yeah, no big deal. I'm gonna digress real quick just because I want to talk a little bit about the women, not just in Henry V, but in Richard II and Henry VI Part 1. There's Joan and all that, but all of these women are given a lot to do, and they're very complicated, three-dimensional characters, right? I mean, hardly. Like, it's...
I am wrinkling my nose.
Yeah, I'm being sarcastic because Catherine's literally a prize that he wins at the end.
And he kisses.
Yeah, this one's interesting though because the women have almost all of the comedy in this play. Like, they get the big laugh lines. Like Mistress Quickly is hilarious.
Yeah,
that Catherine Alice scene is great. When you're playing it for laughs, the one that's all in French, and then it's weird because then it's like, great, no, that's the trophy is Catherine.
Yeah, it doesn't pass the Bechdel test. Although Henry VI,
I don't know that any Shakespeare's plays pass the Bechdel test.
Well, arguably Joan does in Henry VI part one.
I guess when I think Bechdel test, I think a script or a movie in its whole. Though I don't think of just a character.
I think the test is there one scene. Like, I don't even think it's
one
like,
scene. It's got to be at least one scene with two women having a conversation that has not nothing to do with
low
men.
Low bar.
Yeah, it's a low bar.
But Catherine Alice scene, they're just like, hey, you want to teach me English? Because we're probably going to know that need to know that real soon. You don't think it technically passes?
I guess it might technically pass. You might be right. Because they don't start talking about...
They don't really talk about the men at all, other than like an intro about like, he's coming.
Yeah.
I kind of wondered why that scene was even fucking there, other than saying, "Here's this chick, and you're gonna need to know later that she doesn't really speak English."
Yeah, but,
some of the word choices in the French, right? Like, it's a pardon my French. It's a cunt joke. She goes, word gown sounds like cunt, and she goes, "Oh my god, the English talk like that? Are you kidding me?" Like, okay. It's all a big, like, setup to this weird language joke. That whole
scene.
Okay,
all right.
Yeah.
Setting up a bit.
Yeah. And it is a valve release. It does give us some levity in the midst of horrors and intensities and battles and all that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Let's step backwards, because something worth just stepping through. I don't know how well y'all know the Henry IV part one and two story. But I think it's worth talking about because Hal's story is very much told. Henry V's story is very much told in these two plays. So I'm just going to step us through it. Y'all jump in. Correct me. Say anything else that needs to be said. This is like the simplest version of it for me. Mm-hmm. This is my version. I just wrote this down. Hal's a bit of a whore. A bit of a whore.
Yeah.
He's sloppy. Henry IV is a bit disappointed. Yeah, his dad, he's failing upwards. His dad's a little disappointed in it. He sort of like decides he's gonna like change and leads the battle against Hotspur. And end of part one. Great. And then there's like Eastcheap.
Right.
And then part two is him sort of falling back into like the Slutsville. A little bit. And then at the end, he swears off everything that's not kingly and turns his back on Falstaff. End of play.
yeah.
Fill in any other pieces.
I just think like the emotional stakes that help us in Henry V is like Hal and Falstaff are buddies.
Yeah.
They are like sort of raising hell and really good friends. And Bardolph's in there too.
And Pistol and
Pistol's not in. Pistol like pops in like right at the end of Henry IV Part Two.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, he just comes in right at the end.
Yeah.
But like that whole crew, that Eastcheap crew, is Henry's crew from when he was fucking around, and I think that's really important.
Sure.
Even quickly in Tear Sheet.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And so we'll talk Falstaff in a second, because that's a huge actually piece of this play that.
It's huge, which is in the way that it isn't huge.
Exactly. But we have... Actually, let's just get into it. Let's fucking talk about it. We jump around anyway. Let's just do it. Falstaff. Talk to me about Falstaff. Falstaff's like one of the great characters.
He's kind of based on like a Comedia character too, isn't he?
He's kind of
like big, jolly, clowny, drunk,
yes,
fun
he's
guy.
Based on a real knight... slash person named
Fastolf.
Yes. But Fastolf is not the same person. And historically, he is.
But Fastolf is a character in Henry VI.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Same person.
But then he changes
I read that he wasn't.
No,
they are different characters. But like Fastolf is in English history, was a guy who was like a coward and famously ran away from shit. So... Shakespeare wrote him into Henry VI, but then started like playing with this clown character that was like, hey, you know that idiot who's terrified of everything?
And turned him into Falstaff. Right. So then Falstaff becomes like fucking, I don't know, Mrs. Doubtfire. So it like becomes like
hugely popular with the audiences. They love him.
What were you going to say?
He's in a couple of, right? He's in like a bunch of plays. He's in
Merry Wives.
Right? Yes, like, Merry Wives is the answer to the fact that people booed when they found out Falstaff wasn't in this play.
Oh.
That is literally what happens. So you have, so we're in Eastcheap somewhere in like the second act, right? And Pistol and Doll and Quickly and the gang are there, and they're discussing that Falstaff died basically of a broken heart because of Hal, because of Henry V, right? And he just couldn't handle it. But he's not there. He's not in the play at all. And audiences were like, apparently, pissed. Like, they were just like, wait, where? What happened? And part of that, part of the reason he's not in this play is that Will Kemp, the man who played Falstaff in the originals, had left the company. And he was sort of considered the ultimate Falstaff. It'd be like if... it's almost like if someone else had played T'Challa in the new Wakanda Forever. We all would have probably
rejected
it. It's
like when they recast Maria in Sound of Music for the live version.
right.
No. I mean, maybe.
Exactly.
I don't
know. It's like Carrie Underwood
playing Maria.
It's exactly like that. No, but I'm talking like this is a beloved character that's been in a few things by this point, right? And so then... And I'm pretty sure in the Olivier filmed version, the groundlings boo when it's announced that he's dead. I've never seen that version, but I found that in my research. I was like, that's funny. All that to say, I don't remember. What was my point? He was a very beloved character. He writes Merry Wives as sort of like, okay, well, I'll write a play that's just like all Falstaff being Falstaff, basically. Good play, Merry Wives. Good play.
Oh, it's fun, yeah.
Good play that. It's weird.
It's weird, and I like it.
It's a proto-farce. It is, like, one of the first farces. So.
Yeah.
Fun. Anyway, I saw it at Oregon Shakespeare Fest, and the Falstaff was played by a woman, and she was absolutely phenomenal. I should find her name, but it was incredible. Okay. What else?
I think those... I'll just, like, say this about the Ishii... crew.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is so interesting to hold up this character in Hal, who really through war like becomes a leader and like steps into his role, and then you actually Shakespeare is sort of is a negative parallel with Pistol, who gets shittier with war.
right
like you sort of see these trajectories, and you know there's a reason that they sort of like have that scene in the middle with each other, right? Like it's about like, look, war made this person better and it made this person worse. And that's really cool. We'll talk about the Bardolph scene. That deserves its own little mini conversation.
Absolutely.
Well
then let's kind of start from the let's just step through a little bit, because the first thing that happens is a prologue. We have a narrator.
Looking this up. There's only three of Shakespeare plays that have a prologue like this. It's Henry V, it's Pericles, and Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. Right. And I guess could you call the first scene of Taming of the Shrew a prologue in theory? The one that's not usually done? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The play within a play thing. Okay, just wondering. It's true. And you know what I think is interesting about this one, especially because it's a history, is that it's so setting of the scene, like it's the opening prologue of a movie. Like it's we're on the shores of whatever, you know, and you're like,
it's so meta.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so meta theatrical, and that's what's interesting. It's like the coming out going, ah, there's no way we can do this show justice.
Right.
There's no way we can do this well. So I need you all to use your imaginations.
Right.
And then if you turn around and kick ass with it, then, you know, used it well.
In general, during this time, especially at the Globe and things like that, they weren't using sets. They were using costume like a mofo, but they weren't using sets really, because that was too big. It was too insane to produce that. So to have a narrator step out and be like, okay, we're on a ship. Everyone cool with that? You get it? Okay, cool. Like, that's sort of what he's doing. Many scholars believe that Shakespeare himself would have performed the prologue and other...
I read that.
That's cool.
He was probably the guy.
He took some
that.
Of the best speeches for himself. Prologue is fucking great. There's a billion amazing Henry speeches in this, though, too.
I've used
a lot of speeches from this show, and they've all been men's parts.
They're all amazing.
So,
but yeah, I think that intro is fascinating, because I'm like, I didn't go digging, but the other day I was like, wow, this doesn't happen a lot that he does this, Shakespeare.
Scanned as a class in my Shakespeare class.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
RNJ's prologue, I would argue the best example in film that has ever done the prologue is that the Baz Luhrmann RNJ opening, where it's just like the newscast. Yeah. I think that's like sort of the perfect version of what these prologues are. I really love that. I always think of that when I read a prologue. This could be on TV. This could be somebody setting it. I don't know.
Well, Henry Branagh does it so well with
Jacoby
on the movie set and then throwing open the doors and walking into it.
This isn't going to be that big of a deal, but actually it's going to be because we have a huge fucking budget and it's
exactly.
Also, speech. Oscar play.
Check this shit out.
Yeah, it's badass.
I do think it's so interesting, right? The next scene we get the bishop and Ellie and Canterbury, and they're like, how do we manipulate Henry into going to war in France
so we don't get our funds cut?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting. We're about to, like, talk about how nationalistic this play is.
Yeah.
But on its way there, it takes a big dump on the church.
And the politics and all of it.
Absolutely.
Great. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, and so, I think going through this time, the thing that made me cringe the most, too, was even for how good his speeches are, how much he is constantly talking about how what he's doing is ordained by God. And I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
Kind of gross.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that way because you're who you are in 2022 in America. But I think at the time, this was playing to the audience. They're all just like, yes, God!
When he's threatened by those assassins in Act 2, he compares the three... If he said if the three assassins would have been successful in killing him, it would have been equal to the fall of man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Henry, really?
That's what they're taught, man. They're anointed by God. They're God's representative on Earth.
I also think it's worth pointing out that in Henry IV, King Henry IV is talking to Hal and is like, man, if we had had a foreign war, we wouldn't be dealing with all of this infighting. He sort of like plants the seed to be like, hey, if you want to get the England aligned, if you want to get them united, point them at a common enemy. So... Right. I think if you take that with you too, right, there may be some element of Henry being like, all right, church, I see what you're doing, but I'm going to do it anyways. You know what I mean? Like,
sure. Yeah. So we're in Act One. Hal is considered, I believe, by most a just king, just and powerful king of sorts. He sets his sights on France.
He's been proving himself. I think, you know, and that's the symbolism of Falstaff being dead and the funeral is that his childhood ways, you know,
are gone.
The folly of youth is gone, and he is a king now.
But then we have a bit of childish gameplay with the tennis balls.
It's a great fucking speech.
It's
too.
A great scene.
I love that speech.
It's the audience's first time seeing him being kingly, right? Because he sort of comes in and he's like, what do you think, church? And then he's like, wait, didn't the French have something to send in? And the French are like, hey, here's some tennis balls for you, fuck you. And Henry lays in with this incredible speech.
The mockery of the Dauphin hath turned his tennis balls into gunstones.
Gunstones. And I think it's an opportunity for his, like, his cabinet to be like, whoa, this guy... All right, let's go. You know what I mean?
But something also interesting about that is that later in the play, we get to see him be like, well, we'll talk deeper about this, but kind of be more of a common man and talk to the people. And like, he's in disguise, but he's doing that. And then even like plead to God and like do these things that they had never seen a king act this way, probably even on stage, right? So this is like,
oh, yeah.
This is big stuff. Okay, so the tennis balls happen, and then we get into Act Two, where he really, I think this is like sort of the epitome of him proving himself, is the Grey Cambridge and, what's the dude's name?
Scroop, Cambridge, and Cambridge. Northumberland.
Yeah.
Something's buzzing around me, sorry.
Yeah, so they're right there, they're about to cross the channel over into the Henry's like, hey, before we go, you three guys over here, you got anything? I need to give you your orders. And then he sort of hands him a letter that's like, hey, I know what you did, and you did.
Yeah,
He's too smart.
Well, I think it's easy to like see that and just be like, oh, he knows what's going on. But he talks about there's a speech in his speech. He talks about Cambridge specifically, and he's like, we grew up together, dude. Like.
Yeah.
You were going to have me killed, right?
Like, for, like, land?
Yeah.
Like, that was, like, France was like, we'll give you some shit. I don't know.
We talked about this in Henry VI, but Cambridge is Richard Plantagenet, who talks to Mortimer.
Right.
Right.
That's his dad. So if this coup had happened, Richard Plantagenet would have been king.
Right. Mm. I think one of the most interesting pieces of this, though, is that when he brings them up, he first shows an act of mercy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's so good.
It's so good. He grants mercy to someone, and then everyone's confused.
And the guys are like, you should be meaner to him. And he's like, I don't think you want me to be meaner to them.
Do you want that, really? You three are sentenced to death. Goodbye, right?
Yeah.
But here's the thing. We talked about, this is what clicked for me. We talked about Richard II last week. He's learning the lesson of Richard II. He's learned it already. That's why he's doing
this. Decisiveness is as important as the decision
itself.
But
what's so interesting is that what happened to Richard II because he showed mercy was that Henry V's father usurped him.
Right.
So he's like, well, I'm not going to let someone like my dad come along.
Yeah.
But it's cool. It's cool to see, especially that this is a tetralogy, to see that actually matter and it not just be like, and then this happened, and then this happened. It's like, no, he's learned that lesson.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very. Good point. Good point.
So then they land at Harfleur.
Harfleur.
And this is the big once more into the breach, dear friend speech. It's one of the greatest speeches
I've used.
Shakespeare.
Yeah.
It's so good. And there's this weird monologue where he's sort of talking. This is after the big speech. And he's talking to the mayor, and he's like, "Hey, give up." And this is you mentioned this.
It's really rapey.
It is. Well, that's what he says.
Yeah.
It's really rapey, but then at the end, when the mayor gives up, he sort of like leans over to Exeter, and he's like, "Be really nice to all the people in the town, please."
Yeah. Right. but it's a threat. He's coming out and being like, "Hey, I'm gonna rape and pillage and put your heads on spikes. I show no mercy. I'm a dope ass king." And he's like, okay, cool." And then he's like, "Okay, but like, we're not gonna do that.
Just be chill, be cool."
Yeah, we're gonna
be cool. Yeah. And it's again, that's all this meditation that he's doing on the morality of the shit that he's doing. You know, how far can I push this? I have to make it look this way. I have to present that I'm hardcore.
Yeah,
and then I've got to balance that with, you know, because he is, so much of it is if I was a common man, what I'm doing would be immoral. But because I'm doing it for country and my people, then I can rationalize it. But I gotta then balance what I'm doing and saying.
Yeah. So then after that, which is a big battle, he almost loses. They win, and that's kind of the theme. They're always like almost lose, and then they win.
Yeah,
it's very 300.
It's very that. But so then Agincourt, I think, is next.
Well, can I point something out before Agincourt? I love Act 3, Scene 7, where it's all of the Frenchmen. It's a scene where they're making fun of French people, and they're all sitting around talking about, this is going to be so easy. Look at what I'm wearing. And then they talk about their horses like they're their mistresses.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is this a scene where Shakespeare is also calling French people horse fuckers?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Say horse fucker.
I mean, they hated each other. They still hate each other. You want to start a fight between a Frenchman and an Englishman, it ain't hard. You ain't got to do too much.
Hey, I heard that guy called you a horse fucker.
What? No, hell he did. Fucking tell.
All right, sorry. I had to throw that in. Let's go. Agincourt. So next.
Well, it's interesting because he chooses not to go to Paris. He chooses to go to Agincourt because his team, his troops have just been, you know, running so
grim.
Hard. Yeah. And even Agincourt, you know, but it's his best option at that point.
Yeah.
and the night before, right, it sort of assumed that they sort of get there in the dark because they, you know, there's this big scene where the sun comes up and they're like, oh, fuck, we are fucked.
Yeah.
But in that night, he sort of, to your point, like you were alluding to earlier, he pretends to be a commoner and sort of is like going around talking. And this scene with Williams is so fucking good.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It gets right to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's, correct me if I'm wrong, it feels like him questioning war in general.
Oh,
like
yeah.
As a concept through this whole thing, right? Or no?
At least somebody is.
Well, oh yeah. I mean, it's all a meditation on war, I think. And I think that scene that makes him so human, but it also makes his soldiers more human to him, and that's where he's questioning, like, I'm leading these guys into getting fucked, and how do I turn this? How do I spin this? How do I make the most of this? And just, there's no going back at this point. So, you know, and then you get the St. Crispin's Day speech, which
another
is just,
speech I've used.
Yeah, oh yeah, and it's one. I mean, and it's got it all. It is personal, it's emotional, it's patriotic. It obviously is rallying, you know. You know, who doesn't want to stand on stage and yell, you know, God for Harry, England, and St. George, you know? Just like, fucking yeah, dude, I'm in.
I think before Act 4, though, I think it's still within Act 3, is the begging for forgiveness.
Yeah.
It's Act 4, scene 1, but all one long scene. After... He's been going back and forth with the Williams. He has this big, long speech where he's begging to God. Yeah.
What was your take on the Williams discussion, Kevin?
Just that. I mean, Scott hit it. I think it's really interesting because you do not ever come at a king like that. There's a whole bit with Gages, like, where the king's like, fuck you, Williams. If I see you after this, I'm not going to kill you right now because we need your manpower. But before both alive, you and I are fighting.
Yeah.
Rules. And it's just such a cool to see those philosophies back and forth. Williams is like, no, I wanted to stay at home and hang out with my wife. The king made me come here. Yeah. So if I die, that's on the king.
Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that just is just
it's
more
a good perspective for Henry to get too.
Yeah. It's just more weights that's just put on him so that by the time you get to the speech and the battle, which is, I mean, listen, the English still hold on to that battle in terms of national identity. I mean, it just statistically everything was against them. They should have just gotten wiped out and he should have probably just gotten his ass kicked home, but they didn't.
There's also something to be said about being massively underestimated by your enemy. It's always a really good payoff, whether it's in a story and or real life.
Sure.
It's a very good plot device because Shakespeare really fucking sets that up, how the French feel about the English before this battle.
But something that I read about, because I was looking up St. Crispin's Day. I don't know much about it. Okay, so I was looking it up. Apparently in real life, Henry would have known the whole time that it was a complete slaughter. Mm. That, like, apparently in real life, like, 30 English people died and, like, thousands of French died.
Yes.
Which is, like, insane. But Shakespeare makes him not know. So he's like,
he's worried.
Like, I don't know. What's happening? What's going on? But he probably would have known the whole time. It was probably a little less dramatic. But it's still cool. It's, you know, as a storytelling device, plot device.
Oh, yeah. You got to turn it up, right?
I did want to go back 1 second to the pleading to God for forgiveness for his father's usurping.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
This is considered by many to be his sort of like wink wink to Queen Elizabeth, because apparently she hated usurpers. That was like her whole thing. Any royal person probably.
But
she was very vocal about it. So I think a lot of people think that he threw this in there as that. But there's also just like thematic importance to this, it being the end of this story. In a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. Like to remember something and discuss something and ask for forgiveness for something that happened 4 plays ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is just an interesting thing to throw in there. Any takes? Anyone?
No, and we go back to that Richard II stuff that he represented an old school view of what a king should be.
Right.
And Bolingbroke, Henry IV was the new way, but you had to break that line. That lineage had gone on for a long time. That family had been around for a long time, and so he's still feeling that. He's still dealing with it. And then that's really what happens in Henry VI Part One, is that it's all the ramifications from. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens when the Jenga piece has been pulled out and you get 2 generations, a third generation coming up, and how do you hold on to that power? How do the people around you know, latch themselves on and you know, secure their positions as well.
It's been interesting. I'm glad we read Henry VI before we read this, and you kind of get the feeling. Well, and then they say it in the epilogue at the end, where they say like, "Hey, this is great, but guess what? He's gonna die young, and his the next king is an infant, even though they age him up in Henry VI." It was interesting reading it that way, and also interesting because I did just finish God Emperor of Dune. And having that context and coming into these plays about the whole idea of the cult of personality and having a politician that you love, because inevitably they are going to fuck up, or maybe they're going to die young and leave you in a real fucking pickle with how do we do this now because the next king is a child.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
Also, I figure Elizabeth probably did hate usurpers because I'm sure a ton of people wanted to usurp the throne because she was a lady.
Oh my God. And by this point in her life too, these later years, like she had, oh, God only knows how many coups that she and her team fought off, you know, never mind the Catholics. She had all the Catholics against her too.
Never mind the Catholics.
Yeah. Shit. Yeah.
Let's talk Catherine and Henry.
Sure.
For a second, because I think we need to talk that, and then I think we need to talk Bardolph before we get out of here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's start with Catherine and Henry. CJ, you had a take. Get a little deeper into that with me, for me.
Oh, I mean, it was just, I realize that it can be played off completely differently, because he goes in, they do the cute little scene where he's trying to speak French, she's trying to speak English, neither of them are good at it. It seems in the language that they're both kind of, well, he's more forward about them being smitten with one another, but then he goes to take her hand and kiss it, and she says, no, 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 you can't, you're the king, I'm nothing compared to you, and then he goes in to kiss her, and she says, no, no, it's not proper, don't. And he does it anyway. But again, I mean, to me, that's how you direct it. That was just me being a 2022 angry lady when I put that in my breakdown.
No,
like,
no.
She said, no, don't kiss her. But again, I mean, like, the only Henry V I've seen, other than I saw Porters of Hellgate do it years ago. And there was an earthquake in the middle of Act Two. But the only other one I've seen is Kenneth Branagh, and it was him and his... Were they married at that point? I mean, they were clearly really into each other at that point with Emma
Thompson.
Yeah, I was thinking Watson. I'm like, that's not right.
Oh.
You know, they're clearly very smitten with each other with the way that they did their scenes together. So.
Yeah, yeah, they're married by this point, and they've done so much stuff on screen together.
Did they do Much Ado before or after Henry V?
After.
After, okay. Yeah.
I do love that Much Ado.
I love Much Ado.
I think it's interesting. Henry doesn't have to woo her, right?
No.
Like, he can come in and be like, and I get the princess. It is, for some reason, important to her that he get... He doesn't ask for consent to kiss her, but does ask for her consent to for her hand for to marry her. And I've seen it played that she knows a little more English than she lets on. She's
sure.
Sort of like making him...
She's being
like,
coy.
Yeah.
Speak French.
Well, I also think, too, when you think of, like, back to his sister, because Bailey brought it up before in Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, he's kind of, like, messing around and hanging out with sex workers. Like, he's kind of not used to a scrubbed, polished lady. So, I mean, I think that's another thing that kind of makes him more human. You are seeing him be nervous with women.
Mm-hmm. And he's been
in a romantic
so...
way.
He's been so good at everything up to this point in the play, mm-hmm. and to watch him be bad at something
yeah.
is kind of fun.
It's kind of cute. I mean, it definitely, I mean, it's the rom-com at the end of the war movie, I guess.
Sure, yeah, yeah. And it makes him, it really, I think you said it, Kevin, it just makes him even more human, even more mortal, and, you know, selling that, you know, that story of him to a contemporary audience at that time. What are we talking, 1599? Mm-hmm. You know, that's interesting and fun. It's fun.
But yeah, I mean, it's like with almost any Shakespeare, I feel like you could play that relationship, that scene about a million different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
Yeah, a lot of people consider it beautiful. You know, there's sort of, mm-hmm. oh, it's very sweet. It's very nice.
Not Bailey, though. A lot of people do, but not.
Like, you know, the Targaryen love story in House of the Dragons. It's really romantic.
Hot.
It's romantic. It's
hashtag hot. Right. I've never watched that, but it sounds great.
It's terrible.
We love incest on this podcast. What are you talking about?
Stop!
Oh, you're right.
It's trending.
I do not speak for CJ.
It's been trending since, what, 2010, when Game of Thrones started?
Well, it's been trending since year zero.
The Bible.
Since the Bible.
The Bible.
Let's talk Bardolph.
Yeah!
Please, let's.
Tell me about Bardolph.
I love this story, so I'm going to set it up, right? Yeah, this is after Harfleur. They're sort of, like, on their way to Calais, and... Fluellen is such a funny character.
He's supposed to be Welsh, right?
Which is like they were the rednecks of England at the time.
Yeah,
But the joke is like he talks like a hick, but he knows his shit about war.
Yeah.
Pistol comes up and is like, "Hi, are you important? My buddy Bardolph stole a crucifix at a church and they're about to hang him. Can you please, do something about it?" And Fluellen's like, "Ah." First of all, he, like, schools him a little bit in a really infuriating way. He's like, "Well, Lady Justice isn't blind. She's painted blind." It's so stupid. And he sort of passes the information along and doesn't save Bardolph. So Henry comes up and has a moment, has an opportunity to be like, "Bardolph is my buddy. Yeah. That is such a silly, dumb thing to steal. Don't kill him." He doesn't do it. A lot of shows will take the act break here, and they will do the hanging of Bardolph. They will make Henry watch him.
Wow.
Die.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's such a great thing to make that character literally watch his sort of like childhood die in that way. Yeah. It's really powerful. It's really moving, and I think it's a really cool narrative bit.
Yeah.
So I'm finding here he's in both of the Henry IVs. Nim is not.
Right.
But he is in, and Pistol is only in the second one. You were correct. But then he's in Merry Wives. I didn't remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
I wonder where Merry Wives falls in the... Does Shakespeare have a chronology of his plays? What order they go in? All of them?
I think that's alternate timeline. During the snap.
The multiverse is split.
Go listen to our Marvel rankings.
Double nerddom right there. Shakespeare with Marvel sprinkled on top.
Well, what else is Thor? What else is Thor?
The Thor movies are up there for me.
I'm just joking. Kenneth Branagh directed the first one. That's why I said that. Okay. Well, is there anything else, Bardolph, you want to tell? Is there anything else specifically about that? I love the fact that they would add that into an act break.
Yeah.
That's harsh.
That's harsh. It's brutal.
I like it.
Remind me, is it explicit in the play that they do hang him?
They say he is going to be hanged, and Henry kind of goes, "Okay."
Yeah.
And then dismisses. He doesn't show up again. So it's sort of like, it like isn't explicitly stated.
He could show back up in Henry VIII in Game of Thrones land. If you don't go to his funeral, he ain't dead.
If you don't see the body, and even if you see the body these days.
Maybe not, because they'll put some dragon ice in his heart.
Dragon ice.
I mean, yeah, if we're getting multiverse, then they can always come back. Iron Man can come back. Okay. If y'all have any favorite quotes, obviously there's a billion monologues up in here. One that I came across that I was like, "Oh, I see this all the time," because I follow a lot of like stoicism accounts and stuff. "Men of few words are the best men," is one that I've seen probably 1,000 times. I am not a man of few words, so I'm trash. But it's good to know. Y'all have any favorite?
I feel like that would be a quote on like a single lady Instagram.
Yeah, right.
No, I could just list all the speeches for you that I love, but I didn't pick out any specific quotes.
What are your favorite speeches?
Oh my God. Well, the prologue, the tennis ball speech, "Once More Unto the Breach," and "Crispin's Day." Those are the ones that I like wrote down in caps on my notes.
Classiques.
Yeah, they're classics. They're pretty basic bitch stuff.
Yeah, I think we have heard St. Crispin's Day speech over and over and over again. Any screenwriter who has written, like Braveheart or any war movie that has a big inspirational speech before it, is Crispin's Day.
Didn't they use Crispin's Day in an actual commercial, like a video game commercial? There was one Shakespearean, like, big war play that they used, and it was for a video game a couple years ago.
I feel like you're correct, and I'm 99% sure it was Fortnite.
But anyway,
oh,
I interrupted
no, I hate
you.
That. No, that's it. It's just like, it. I think it's one of the best speeches in the Shakespeare canon. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's the blueprint for so many other speeches that we know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. He could write some words. He could put some words together. He could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we could probably go another 10 hours talking Henry V. Is there any final word y'all want to do? Because there's a lot of stuff we got to finish up with today.
No, I dig the fuck out of this play, though. And I'm
good play.
Glad.
Good play.
Right. Kevin, this was your suggestion, right?
Yeah. Bailey was like, what do you want to read? And I was like, well, you got to do Henry V.
Oh, I'm glad you suggested it. Because yeah. I was like, oh, I've already done that. Like, it didn't. I was like, I already knew which one I wanted to pick for my own reasons. But I'm glad I hadn't revisited it in a while. And it's a good one.
I hadn't sat down and just read it in, I can't remember when. I decided not to watch anything that I was just going to sit down. And it took me 2 solid readings. I think it took me 4 hours total to get
it
through
took me
it.
A while to get
I couldn't even find the Branagh one.
Really?
It's not streaming anywhere.
No shit. No,
you can find clips all over YouTube, but you got to buy it.
Of course. Yeah. Huh.
Well, no. I couldn't even buy it on Google or Apple. They wouldn't.
I think
it wasn't
rented
even,
it
or
Family
Amazon.
Video when I watched
Interesting.
It.
Yeah, it was weird. They're probably rebooting it. I'm bad joke. Okay.
We're going to have to ask you to step outside.
I'll step out.
Thank
See
you
later.
All right.
Y'all finish without me. All
right.
What are the final things we got to do?
Well,
dream rolls rankings.
We got
oh,
do
my
love
favorite
ranking
thing.
Shit.
I do love
ranking.
Then
we got a dream
shit.
Rolls and then
there
we got
are
the
dream
spit,
rolls.
And then we got spitlets.
Spitlets. Well, let's start with the thing I love so much.
Yeah.
Bailey loves ranking shit.
I do. I love ranking shit. We're going to rank these 3 plays.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. This is 3, 2, 1. We're going to start with CJ. What was your least favorite of these 3 plays?
Henry VI. And then 2 was Richard II. And then 1st was Henry V for me.
Okay. Wow. Yep. Scott?
Mine was Henry VI part 1.
Number 3.
Then Henry V, then Richard II.
Wow. I wondered if yours was going to be like that.
Wow. Kevin?
Yeah. It's a hard
I'm
call.
I'm a CJ. Yeah. I'm a CJ. Henry VI part 1 is hot garbage. Yeah. Richard
II. It's a mess.
Is great. Henry V is my favorite Shakespeare play, hands down.
Yeah.
Boom. Bam.
Yeah. It's really hard for me to say this, but I'm comparing it to 2 plays that rule because I'm directing it right now, so I feel bad, but it's a fucking mess. Henry VI is number 3. And then I think just on pure enjoyment for Bailey, it goes Henry V, number 2, and then Richard II, number 1. Yeah. I had a lot of fun with Richard II. And then Henry V, I already kind of knew and wasn't as surprised by it. I was very surprised by Dickie too. So I think that's why
when
it's taking the ranking
today.
You loved
Richard II as a person, too.
I kind of want to kick it with him.
Yeah.
I think
you
he and
are,
I would have been
you
good
are
roommates.
A Henry II apologist. Or Richard II apologist.
Yeah. I am.
And also,
we stand a legend.
Stand a legend.
Speaking of, let's do dream rolls, because... Yeah, I want to play Richard too. I want to play Dickie too.
Fuck yeah, do it.
Real bad.
Real bad.
I'm not really the right type,
Dickie,
but I want to do
Dickie
it.
Too.
Dickie
What'd
too.
What'd you say, Kevin?
I'll Bolingbroke your Dickie too.
Yes.
I kind of want to Bolingbroke it too. Yeah, but yeah, I love.
Scott, you direct. Kevin will Bolingbroke. Okay. I will fucking Dickie too. And CJ can play all of the other parts.
Okay, great.
Done. And Austin Allman can be in it too.
But can I still say my dream roles?
Yeah, I was about to say my others, okay. But go ahead.
No, you finish.
Bardolph. Now you.
Prologue, Henry V, Joan, Richard II, or Bolingbroke. I just want all the leads.
Sure.
Scott?
Similar. I would love to do... I've got my monograph where I play both Richard II and Bolingbroke.
Will you do it with that accent the whole time?
I do it with this accent for both
Swamp
characters.
People the whole time. Yeah,
I just love it. I mean, I'm not quite right to play any of them, but you know what's right? Ian McKellen just did Hamlet in his 80s, so you can do whatever the fuck you want with it. Yeah, it's Shakespeare.
Kevin.
Okay.
You got any more, Scott?
Bardoff. Sure. I would gladly play any of those Duke roles. Northumberland might be fun to do, but just to be with a bunch of other actors and playing those characters that are scheming and just trying to keep shit held together, and they're all fucking just juicy as hell.
Kevin.
I was lucky enough to play Pistol once upon a time, which was really fun.
In five,
yeah,
sick.
Yeah.
Sick.
With Jonathan Majors as our head.
That's
major.
Right, that's right.
Oh, shit, that's right.
Radical.
That's awesome.
Shout out to Jonathan Majors, friend of the podcast. I'm kidding.
You're
Henry
Jonathan
Five.
Majors.
Henry V is, like, by far bucket list role, so want to make that happen, and then probably Bolingbroke. I'm a slut for the Henrys.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, you slut.
Yeah, slut.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So then let's that's kind of wraps up the Henry stuff. So why don't we spotlight some LA theater?
Yeah.
LA spotlight.
Spitlets. Let's spotlight LA theater.
We're doing it.
We've got
Reflect on Women, which is a part of Sacred Fool's Ladder Up program. It's overseen and run by James McQueen, who's a choreographer. And it's two nights, December 16th and 17th at the Broadwater second stage. And it's female choreographers. There's eight total, right, Siege? Eight total.
Yes,
four,
that sounds right.
Four on each night. And it's a really cool program. Again, I've shouted her out multiple times, but a big shout out to CJ for helping put that together and for reaching out to James and helping facilitate that. But it's a new initiative that Sacred Fools is working on and trying to give space, resources to folks and young artists and up and coming artists of color. And so it's really cool. And I'm proud that we're doing it, and it should be a fun couple nights. Come on out.
Yep. Siege.
Y'all still have one more weekend to see the Christmas show at Loft. Mrs. Dilber's Fabulous Bed Curtains. I'm going to see it this Friday.
I may join
Fridays
you
and Saturdays. You should. Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 7. Loftensemble.org.
Yeah.
Kevin, you got anything?
I don't have any theater, but I am going to see Enchanted Gardens at Enchanted Lights at Descanso Gardens last year. It is really cool.
That sounds amazing. Bed. Yeah.
Yeah, go out there and do some Christmas shit, y'all. See some movies. Look at some lights.
Yeah.
If you're in the LA area in March, come see Henry VI, Part 1 and 2.
Hell
done by
yes.
high schoolers at a Polish church where all of the flags are red and white, and it's incredible. There's a beer garden in a gazebo, and it's very fun.
Can I drink while watching the show?
Probably not, but you can get real high.
It seems wildly inappropriate, but yeah. I will be high. Yeah. Take some. Goodness.
I don't know. I'll ask them. Well, maybe we can do that.
They're doing Rent at the Broadwater right now.
Yes, Rent is happening at the Broadwater. I don't have
a rental. A rental is doing Rent.
Leggett mentioned getting loaded and going and seeing it, and I kind of want to.
Well, let's do it.
Thanks. I don't know. I'm about to say something awful. Should I say it? I'm going to say it. It's the last episode of the season, y'all.
Noted.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Nobody's listening this deep. I truly, like, actually, no.
Oh, you're backing
off. I'm not going to say that.
You're backing off. Right on.
I will get canceled. I'm not going to say any of that.
No.
Y'all, just because you're doing a good show doesn't mean it's good. That's all I'm going to say. That was mean.
I think that's a pretty good...
Yeah. Hashtag hot take, dude. I'm not... you're not wrong.
But also, I saw Angels in America at the Broadwater. That was just a rental where actually my friend Mikey Mulhern put it up. And was it good? No. Was it still Kushner? Yes. And did I enjoy myself? Yeah. I was in the sixth hour being like, yeah, still good.
Yeah.
Still good. Okay, cool. We should get out of here. Thank you all for joining us for this season.
Yeah, it's the end of the season. Three seasons, y'all.
We're at like 130 episodes or something. Like we're like pretty deep.
So much content.
120, something like that. But yeah, we appreciate you. This is the end of our Shakespeare histories miniseries as well. The life of, I forgot what it was. It was funny, wasn't it? Henpod the Poop.
They're all really Henpod, good.
It was the life of Henkast the Pod.
The pod.
It's beautiful. You know how I love the sweaty ones.
Yeah, it's sweaty. We like it. Thank you, Kevin, for joining us.
Yeah, what a
great
treat.
Great having you here.
It's been really great.
Let's do Shakespeare movie adaptations next
season. Yeah, we'll do that next season. We'll do Shakespeare movie adaptations. Yeah. That'll be
we
great.
We have to fill a lot of bonus episodes next season because the podcast is having
a baby.
We're not going to be doing legitimate episodes moving forward, playwright miniseries moving forward. We might do like five next year.
Yeah, we're doing
I know
we're
thinking of
Illegitimate playwrights only.
Only the bastards.
but we're going to be an interesting bend for the season. Which, that's like part of Scottopedia. This playwright was a bastard.
But besides that, we're going to probably in January, like, batch a bunch of episodes one night when my baby's sleeping and then release them for a while. But we're just going to do, like, instuffs. We're going to talk Theater Nightmares again, which is still one of our most listened to episodes. People love that shit.
I love it.
We're going to do movie discussions. And yes, Kevin, we'll have you back for as many episodes as you want to come back for.
Yeah.
Bring it back. And if you want to do the problem plays next year with us too.
Yeah.
But wow, good season, y'all. We appreciate you. This is the end until
this is the end.
I don't know, January sometime. End of January.
Early February. Yeah.
We'll be back for season four. See?
Oh, hey, y'all have questions or comments? Tell us movies we should be watching. Tell us send us your theater nightmares. You can do that via email, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Scott.
Thank you so much, CJ. A big final for the season. Shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song, and our theme song is better than your theme song.
It's true.
He's also the writer of all of our stingers, and he's an amazing human being. A big shout out to Pam Quinn, who is a frequent contributor to our show. She wrote our In Stuff bonus theme song. She writes special episode playwright-centric themes and songs for us. We love her to death. And then finally, to the great Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Annie Baker, who writes every single one of our episodes.
Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
This is Annie.
Yeah?
Hi.
Hi, Annie.
I wanted to let you know that I'm retiring from writing your podcast for next season.
Annie!
No, I'm handing off the writing to Carol Churchill.
Oh, all right.
Well, in that case, a big thank you to Carol Churchill.
Carol
Churchill.
Poor Carol.
One day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
Yeah, a pint.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. Bye.
Bye.
Happy holidays.
There's the golden apple and golden rainbow, golden boy and Goldilocks. Writing should be easy, like a monkey driving a speedboat. Beg, borrow, or steal, Buck White, big deal, and bring back Birdie and Bagels and Yaks. Close your eyes. Breathe. Oh, oh, oh. Ladle into that barrel of monkeys that you call ahead and scoop out an image monkey. There's Hurry Harry, happy as Larry, Marilyn, and very warm for May. Now let that image monkey, May, drive a speedboat, and you water ski behind it. Oh, brother, oh, boy, oh, captain, oh, look, oh, please, oh, coward, oh, my dear. Okay. Stay behind the image and write down what you see on your monkey ski trip. Ready? Go, okay. See the monkey? Sail away on a speedboat. Okay, I'm not going to do the whole song.
Did you say bagel and yachts?
Yeah, it's from title of show, and they're just listing all of the musicals that Broadway has ever done in a song. It's fine. Hi.
Hi, bye.
Later, everybody.
The theater, the theater. Hang out, Louie!
Theater, theater.